everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Baldwin. With me right now as we are recording, he is thinking about that he's going to be, when this comes out, he will be sunning himself on the beautiful beaches of Anna Maria Island, nipples taut, facing the sun, getting a beautiful tan, while hoping, beyond hope, that he does not contract the flesh-eating bacteria that is near Anna Maria Island. Barry, you've got to be on your toes, literally and figuratively.
The flesh-eating bacteria. So there was a death. A woman contracted this literally on Anna Maria Island, right at Bradenton Beach, which is Coquina Beach. So that's literally probably within a mile of where I am. But, you know, I look at it this way, too. I think two people have actually contracted the flesh-eating virus in the state of Florida this year. And I think of the millions of people that are in the water on basically a daily basis. So I think the odds, Jeff, you know, shit like that, sharks, flesh-eating virus, I just, you know, you live your life, you do it. Of course, I say that prior to contracting the flesh-eating virus. So
this is true.
If I do catch it, I will be whining like a baby.
Well, I will only say, for the benefit of the Baldwin family, that my brother Chip lives in Destin, up in near the Panhandle.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, my brother now, as he's gotten older, Mr. Beach Life, we love the beach here in Destin. Also read that there is a flesh-eating bacteria case up in the Destin area. Strangely, though, brother not posting anything about the flesh-eating bacteria up in the Panhandle. You know, he still loves that beach life, though.
Yeah, and that's a fact, too. 12-year-old girl. That was actually the one on Anna Maria Island in Coquina Beach. I think she was a 77-year-old woman that actually cut her leg in the water while she was in the water on a pillar or something like that. But the other one was a 12-year-old girl in Destin. And Destin also, if I'm correct, is like hammerhead shark capital of the world. They're known for just getting swarms of hammerhead sharks for some reason. So a lot of shit goes down. You know, Jeff, you're not a beach guy, so you're safe. But, you know, you get to the beach, you know, whether it's fucking sharks or barracudas or, you know, fucking flesh-eating virus now or lightning or something, something's going to get you. I still think it's more dangerous to drive where you live, Jeff, in South Florida than
Accurate.
Any of the things that we just said. Exactly, right? Accurate.
And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the flesh-eating bacteria. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, wrestling, life, hell. Today's episode 93, Barry, we are going to be, not only discussing the flesh-eating bacteria, we'll be discussing a couple of interesting, dare I say, for the first time, I think, Barry, two masturbation stories.
Wow.
You know, get your hand lotion out, Barry, because we're ready to go on these two stories that are pretty compelling stuff. We are also going to be discussing a part two of our Q&A portion. We did part one, took about 25 questions. Going to try to see if we can get about 20, 25 questions. The second part, besides all that, Barry, hey, how about a special guest this week? How about the man they used to call Mr. Olympia himself, Jerry friggin' Stubbs? Used to be partners with Ted DiBiase in Mid-South and was one half of what I think might be one of the all-time most underrated tag teams of the 80s when he teamed up with a young wrestler named Arn Anderson in the Southeastern area. Barry, that was a really solid team.
Yeah, and everything you just said is correct, too. And Jerry Stubbs is one of these guys, and I've been saying this, and I was talking to our friend Nick Massey the day before, and I said, I think Jerry Stubbs, and this is obviously a question that we'll ask him later, too, I think he was a homesteader, and I think he was a guy that really wanted to stay in the South, whether it was, you know, Alabama, Continental, or maybe Knoxville. And I think, you know, the farthest west he ever went that I'm aware of would have been Mid-South. But he was a guy that was kind of just local, but he had all the tools as a professional wrestler. He was probably as good as you got in the 80s. And I think he's really one of the most underappreciated professional wrestlers. And I think that's based off that he didn't go to the NWA. I know he spent a little time in Crockett, you know, years earlier, but he just wasn't a guy with that national exposure. But as a professional wrestler, I think he's one of the best of the 80s.
Yeah, he had a really, really good run in Mid-South. I want to say around 83-ish. Maybe into early 84. He did a great, great angle. I happened to watch it again the other day. Barry, the angle with Mr. Olympia and Mr. Wrestling 2 with the suitcase full of Mr. Wrestling 2's gear that was destroyed, and it was really a fun angle. And like I said, half of the tag team, he got to watch a young Arn Anderson develop right in front of him there in the Southeastern Territory. We're going to be discussing all those things plus more. So, Barry, before we get to our Q&A segment, it's time for the first time here on Breaking Kayfabe. We're going to break kayfabe by God right here on masturbation. I can now hear the shrieks of horror coming from my parents' house as they now hear me discussing this. Barry, I'm going to do a little, I guess I'm going to call it a one-off, no pun intended, on the Florida Man series. Barry, tell me if this is Florida Man or not, okay?
Okay.
Airplane passenger accused of trying to join the Mile High Club on trial. Enrique Gonzalez of Rancho Cucamonga reportedly masturbated on a United Airlines flight on February 3rd. This is the part of the story I love, Barry. While his wife tried to help him. You know, what kind of good, solid wife does this guy have? A California man on trial in federal court on charges of lewd, indecent, or obscene conduct during a flight to San Antonio earlier this year was found guilty. The report said that he masturbated on a United Airlines flight on February 3rd while his wife assisted him. Barry, Florida or not? I will say
the story started
off in Rancho Cucamonga.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
Are you asking was the plane over the state of Florida when this act was occurring? Like
here's another non-pun. There was a landing strip, but it was not Mrs. Gonzalez, okay? But
all right.
So tell me where the plane landed, where this guy was arrested and put in front of a federal judge.
I'm confused by this. So his wife, like, this was out in the open, like he's doing it and then she's just helping him out in the open.
Well, you'd like to think he had the courtesy to get a blanket, you know, to have a little discretion, but apparently they're right there in the middle of a flight on United Airlines and this guy's yanking one off, you know, I mean, so, but when they landed, he got in a spot of trouble there with the local authorities.
Yeah. Which I'm thinking if it was a little more undercover, I'll break kayfabe on this, Jeff. In 1986, I had a little assistance from someone, a young lady that I was dating. On a flight, it was a night flight. The lights were out. There was a blanket over my lap, and she decided to. And it was like, you know, what the hell? A different world, 1986 as well. But again, we were discreet about it. Nobody saw, and it was fun. But I'm going to say
you hope no one saw.
Yeah,
you could have poor old lady that was just horrified and still reliving that.
They hope that they didn't see. Absolutely. I'm going to say no. I'm going to say it was not Florida. I'm going to say he was going from California to New York.
San Antonio, Texas. Found guilty.
Oh, a short flight.
Federal court. Well, apparently it was. Only Mrs. Gonzalez knows for sure. But I want to give a special shout out to my boys on the Obtuse Angles podcast. I blatantly stole this story. They talked about it this week, and yeah, I found it just so hilarious. I had to include it. Okay, so now story number two, provided to us by our very own lovely Mrs. Bowdrin, who calls me today as we are getting set to record and says, I have the most interesting story to tell you about a patient of mine. Now, of course, HIPAA rules say I certainly can't name this person. Barry wouldn't think of or doing that, dream of doing that. So my wife has this young woman who she described as 33 years old, who has an injury to her left wrist. Once again, for the edification of our good folks listening, my wife is an occupational therapist, deals in hand, finger and wrist injuries all the way up to the elbow. So Mrs. Bowdrin is treating the young woman, her left hand, by the way. And the woman says, I'm just telling you right now, you need to get this work going because I need to have my wrist working again. My wife says, well, we'll do whatever we can. We're going to, you know, do whatever we can to strengthen your hand and wrist and get it back to working normal. The woman says, no, you don't understand. This is the hand that I use to masturbate with. Tells her therapist that, Barry. Very, very nice and open policy apparently there in the office. And my wife says, you can use your right hand to do that if you'd like. At which point the woman says to my wife, no, you don't understand. My left hand is my dominant hand. Oh, my. Things happening there at the old clinic. So then the woman, my wife is fitting her for a soft cast, maybe a sleeve to help in the healing process. The woman says, now, when am I supposed to wear that? My wife says, well, you do that at night when you go to sleep. No. The woman says, you don't understand. My husband is a trucker. And I need to use that wrist, if you know what I mean, when my husband's home. So somewhere out there, This woman is TCB, baby. She's taking care of business, not only with herself, but with her husband. So, you know, and then the best part of the story is, I'm not sure if it's the best part, but I tell my wife, I said, you know, I got to share this with the fine listeners here. This is just too good a story. And my wife says, oh, that's why I told you. So, you know, round of applause for Mrs. Bowdrin coming through with the content for the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Appreciate that, honey. Well, anyway. So
absolutely. Supplying us with content, Mrs. Bowdrin. By the way, are there photos of this young woman that that has to masturbate frequently all throughout the day? Do we have any photos of her?
Well, of course, HIPAA laws would prevent. You know, I'm hoping the wife can take out the iPhone and say, "Oh, I'm just looking at my eye makeup and click, 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 and I'll post them on her page." I doubt that. So anyway, so Barry, before we get to our interview, why don't we handle a couple of the Q&A questions that we didn't get to last week? Are you ready to go, my man?
Oh, I am revved and ready. I love this segment.
Revved and ready to go. First question comes from Shard Johnson. Shard wants to know, Barry, is Danny Trejo the greatest movie villain of all time? And I will credit Ariel Agbalog for asking a similar type question. So Danny Trejo, greatest villain in movie history?
I don't know if he is, and I'll tell you, he certainly was a great villain up until a point, but then there was this babyface turn that occurred at some point, and I think he's strictly a babyface at this point. In his earlier days, maybe, and from Dusk to Dawn, I mean, that's just such a great role, but there were so many great roles prior to that, but it does seem like everything he's done the last 10 or 15 years has been babyface, so I don't know if he's the greatest villain, certainly a solid villain, though. Let me think on that one.
Jack Palance, Lee Van Cleef, squinty-eyed Lee Van Cleef, you know. But Trejo was good. Of course, Con Air, was he? What was he? Yeah, exactly. But Con Air, wasn't he Johnny 23, something like that? And I think his comment was, if they knew the real truth, I'd be Johnny 99 or something, where he was the
something
the,
like that. Yeah,
yeah, something like that. So, yeah, no, great, right? Great character actors, yeah. Actor that we love Danny Trejo. So, okay, Kenny Culler wants to know, Barry, what's Joe Pesci's best movie role?
I mean, he's going to be, in my opinion, he's going to be known for Goodfellas, which is probably his best role, his most well-known role. But, Jeff, if we go back, and this is funny, if we go back to the genesis of the podcast, it really kind of started off with a phone call between you and I discussing Easy Money. And somehow that made it on, I think, to the first episode, maybe the second episode. But we had like this long conversation about how fucking great Easy Money was. So I'm going to go with Easy Money. Most people are going to say either My Cousin Vinny or Goodfellas. But for me, it's Easy Money.
Well, a couple others that you didn't mention were his role in Casino, where he was excellent. And also, I believe he might have either been nominated or won the Academy Award for Raging Bull. Jake LaMotta's brother, he was terrific in that. And then, of course, he got into the Lethal Weapon series. And although that was fun, it really sort of took the edge off of him as the actor that was really scary in Casino and Goodfellas. But no, Joe Pesci's just great. And you're right. I love him in My Cousin Vinny, too. He's terrific. Good question there from Kenny. Tom Hale wants to know, Barry, what is your best seafood restaurant experience?
Oh, shit. When I saw this question pop up, I got like – and seafood's a funny thing, Jeff, too, because people – nobody goes, yeah, I'm okay with seafood. People either love seafood or they want nothing to do with it. So that the same girl that was giving me a handy on the airplane in 1986, her parents were loaded, and they took us to a restaurant. I was with her for 4 years. They took us to a restaurant. It would have been 86, 87. It was in New York City. It was called Valencia, and it was a Spanish seafood restaurant, and the father ordered this cold platter of seafood, and it was like gigantic jumbo shrimp, cracked lobster tails, crab claws, all this fucking melted butter and cocktail sauce, and this thing was just massive, and it was an appetizer for four people, and only three were going to eat it because his wife wasn't going to eat any of this. So the three of us sat there and just went insane for this thing, and it was an appetizer, and I don't have any idea what the entree was. I think I got like a grilled fish or some shit like that. But it was this appetizer, and it was like literally I had like three lobster tails off of this thing. So it was just, you know, it's something that I could never afford to do on my own at any point in my life. Gluttonous beyond belief. It was absolutely fantastic, though.
So let me ask you, I don't know if I've ever asked you this question. Of course, anyone that comes down to South Florida to visit is always told to go hit Joe's Stone Crab, especially in the season. Sure. Have you ever gone to Joe's?
Absolutely. And I was, so when I, again, when I saw the question, my first response also is I was going to talk about Joe's because, and Joe's is a great experience, and stone crabs are, it's a gift from God. I mean, if you've never had a stone crab and you like crab, it's probably the greatest thing. And I actually like them cold. I like them cold with the mustard sauce. I still like them hot with the butter. It doesn't matter, but Joe's is a great experience. You know, you get the hash browns, you got to bribe the maitre d' to get a table. You're still going to wait an hour, but it is a quality of food and as a dining experience. And if you like stone crab, it's kind of a rite of passage in a sense. If you're in South Florida, you've got to go there. Absolutely. Have you ever been, Jeff?
I have not. Somehow I'm going to have to convince Mrs. Baldwin before we leave to go down to Joe's. She's not a seafood person at all.
You want the good news or the bad news, Jeff?
Lay it on me.
Lay it on you. I believe Joe's is closed right now. So Stone Crab season.
Mrs. Baldwin will not be going.
I know it ends in May. I think it begins in November, maybe October, and goes to May. And then Joe's is actually closed in the interim. So, or at least it used to be. Maybe they figured out a way to freeze them and serve them, but I don't know. But if I make it down to Georgia, I mean, maybe Georgia isn't known for stone crabs, but we'll definitely get some stone crabs. They're absolutely fantastic.
Hey, Barry, we are especially happy to be joined by the man that they used to call Mr. Olympia, Jerry Stubbs. Barry, how cool is that?
It's pretty cool to me. Now, a lot of people it might not have been too cool for, but when I first went under the mask, you know, that it was intriguing for me because, you know, as a teenager, you know, a lot of people look at their appearance and all, but I had thin hair when I was growing up, and 15, 16, 17 years old, I had real thin hair. So I knew I was going to go bald. And one day, old Bob Armstrong said, "Hey, man, you need to put you on a mask and go with Mr. Olympia because your body looks good," and so on and so on. And I said, "You know, I'm going to do that." And that's what I did. I put that mask on, and I went as Mr. Olympia. After that, it was just, you know, I moved on up here, moved on up in Mid-South with Junkyard Dog and against Junkyard Dog at one time, and Ted DiBiase and all the greats.
Let me ask you, this is a question I ask every guest. When Jerry Stubbs was a kid, when did you first start getting into wrestling, and who was the first wrestler that you were really, you found yourself interested in?
Well, you know, I never was interested in a lot of wrestlers, but I had a friend that was Robert Fuller, and he lived in the area, and we knew, and I grew up, you know, I was in the police department, and I knew him, my cousin and myself and all. We all went to school and we'd all play around, you know. And one day that he just said, "Hey, we need somebody on TV. You want to work?" I said, "Sure, I'll come up work. You know, I've been doing that." I said, "As long as y'all don't kill me, I'll come up." And so I went up there, and then on it was just, you know, every so often I do a lot of TVs. I got to work with Harley Race. I got to work with all the greats, man, the Anderson Brothers.
Now, we're talking about the old Georgia Championship Wrestling area here.
Right, right.
Okay. The
Georgia Championship, because I lived around this area and I had a job, so I would do a lot of jobs for them, and go to different places, and they would book me, and I'd make more doing that than I would in the police department, because back then you didn't make a whole lot of money. So I would do that, and just one thing led to another, till it just so happened, you know, I went up to Knoxville and got in with the Fullers and worked as a matador one time under the mask, and so on and so on. And eventually when we went to Panama City and Pensacola area, we bought that. Well, I said the Fullers bought the territory. They took me with them. And that's when I put the mask on here and built myself up. And just, you know, from there, it was just up, up, up.
Yeah, so a couple of things, too. If you look at the early part of your career, which it looks like it was 1976 when you started, you worked with some amazing talent that was also up and coming at that point. Guys like Ricky Steamboat and Rick Martel and Bob Backlund. So you had all these guys all these guys who were young guys who became, you know, you all became a real force in professional wrestling. Who would you say your earliest influences when you were wrestling? Who was kind of responsible for molding Jerry Stubbs?
I would say it was Rocky Johnson. He took me down to Griffin when he was in Atlanta for a long, long time. I worked with the police department. He said, come on down, work out with us. And I did. I worked out with him. And the Rock couldn't have been more than 2.5 foot tall when we started down there. So I knew him when he was a kid and almost a baby and so on. But he was the one that really kind of stuck me out there and said, hey, man, you got it. You just need to do it. You know, so we worked out on weekends, on Sundays when I wasn't doing anything. He'd take me down there, work out with me and beat me up and all that kind of stuff. And I just enjoyed it. And one day it just came to where either I got to do the police job or either I got to go on the road with the wrestling degree.
Wow. And so Jeff and I both, all of our formative years were spent in the state of Florida. And as I go through all my files, you had one match in Tampa on April the 27th, 1976. You filled in for Skip Young, Sweet Brown Sugar, and teamed with Don Curtis to face Bob Orton Sr. and Bob Orton Jr. So how come you never got a run in the state of Florida?
I don't know. You know, a lot of times, you know, they would call and Ole and all them would send me down to Tampa to work TV. I wasn't working in that area, and they had all the guys that they needed, I guess, at that time. And never was a spot to where I could go and work for a while. So I never was asked to go down in the Tampa area. I was just asked to come down and do several TV, you know, spots for the guys and so on. And they'd fly you down there and fly you back home. And that's all. I never was asked to go to Tampa because I would have went to Tampa. I love Tampa.
Let me ask you, Jerry, I happened to, I was doing a search on YouTube of some of the matches. There's quite a bit of Jerry Stubbs out there for the folks listening. If you want to really see a guy that had his stuff together. And I noticed one of the very early matches that's out there on YouTube is a match, I want to see from like maybe summer of 78. You were in Mid-Atlantic in the Carolinas, and you had a TV match with Harley Race. Do you remember that?
Yes. That's when I first started.
And I
did pretty good. I went more than 5 minutes.
No, I was going to say, I mean, you're in with the guy at that point. He was in his prime, Harley Race. Man, that must have been a real learning experience to be able to, you know, just be at his feet and learn all the stuff that he could show you.
Oh, yeah, man. And he was just a master. He was the master. And, you know, I went on. I said, man, I feel privileged to go that long with the world champion.
You and know? Now, again, was that just a TV appearance? Were you in that area or just going in for TV?
Yeah, it was a TV appearance, but I was working that area. I was working Charlotte with Steamboat and all the guys up in that area at that time. I was working with them, and they just come. They said, hey, we need somebody to work with Harley Race. And I stuck my hand up, and I said, I'd love to, you know. And they said, okay, you got it. Come over here and get with Harley. And yeah, I got over there and got with Harley, and he said, boy, I just, you know, just will it be easy? And I'm going to make you look like a champion. I said, in 5-6 minutes, he made me look like a champion. You know? So, and I said, hey, man, I could, you know. Then I saw him again in Japan. We went to Japan a few times, and we talked this, that, and the other. And he told me to do this and do that. And Wrestling 2, Mr. Wrestling 2 was a big influence in me getting in the business and doing what I did. He would coach me and tell me what I need to do, what I didn't need to do. And he'd hit me with that knee every once in a while because they put me against him and TV and Macon, Georgia sometimes. And he'd hit me with that knee and he said, how'd you like that? You know, I'd laugh. I said, oh, I loved it. You know?
Yeah, I'm going to get to Mr. Wrestling 2 in a little bit because there's more to that story that I want to talk to you about. But I wanted to ask you, so how long did you stay in the Mid-Atlantic area? Do you remember?
I was there probably close to 3 years, maybe.
Oh, you were there that long?
Yeah, 2.5-3 years. I was there. I went in the first time as Jerry Stubbs and did a little deal, da-da-da-da, and then later on I went it back in after I got built up as Mr. Olympia, and we teamed up with Junkyard Dog.
Gotcha. So if I look at it, too, the Mid-Atlantic area, working for the Crockett's, looks like the first territory where they really started to give you a little bit of a push too, where in Georgia, you had been around Georgia for a couple of years, but you get to the Mid-Atlantic area and you're on kind of a win streak at this point. You're getting a bit of a push. I've always thought this too. And I said this to Jeff earlier too. Was there ever any consideration for your career to go national, to say, to go up north or to go out west? It seems like you stuck around the South and maybe went as far as to work for Watts in the Mid-South area. But I've been saying this for years. You had every tool to be a world champion. You were in the ring. There was nobody smoother than Jerry Stubbs in the 1980s. So did you ever consider going up north or out west?
Yeah, I did. And I inquired about it and so on and so on. Went to a lot of Japan trips, you know, with the guys and all that. But never had that really person to say, hey, we'd like for you to come to up here in New York or whatever. I did one time, me and Arn Anderson, we were going, Ric Flair was taking us up to New York. And we was going to work for New York. Arn went. But at that time, I developed a blood clot in my leg. I was going to be the only, actually at that time, I would have been the only masked wrestler at that time. Flair said, you'll be the only one, won't be another, you know. And I developed that blood clot, and that just knocked my whole thing out of it.
So let me just ask you, when, at what point in time, what was the mechanizations like? How did you get approached to go to Mid-South with the Mr. Olympia mask and as a Mr. Olympia character? Bill called you, or who called you? How did that all start to work?
What happened, I think Ron Fuller called. He said Bill Watts called. He said they've been looking at some pictures and some films of you, Mr. Olympia, and they trying to make a decision between you and Mike Sharp at the time, which one they were going to take. And then they called back and they said, we would like for him to come over here. We'll do this. We'd like for him to come talk. We talked about a guarantee and so on. And Junkyard Dog was there. Him and Bill was kind of tight. And Junkyard Dog says, I want you to be my partner, you know, this, that, and the other. And I said, I'd love to be your partner, you know. And we did. We were a partner for, I guess, close to almost 2 years before I turned on him. And we went that area. But we had a good run. Everything just started to gel. It just started to come up, you know.
So
hey, I'll be with you in just a minute. It just started to come up, you know, and everything was good. So and it just clicked, you know.
So I'm
and
just curious.
I got a good run out of there.
I'm just curious, Jerry. Bill Watts, of course, was notoriously protective of JYD, as he should have. I mean, he was his biggest star in the area. So were you given any kind of, listen, Jerry, we need to have you do the bulk of the work on the tag here, and you give the hot tag to JY, so, you know, he gets put over the like the champ. Was it pretty much something like that?
Yeah, he all the time, you know, say, so, you know, JYD is our star. And I said, I understand that. I said, I'm the second star because I'm going to be with him, you know. And
yeah.
I said, whatever he needs, I said, I can carry the match. At that point, I was in good shape. I did this. I did that. I said, you just leave it me. I tell Dog every time we got a dog, you just take it easy. I'll let you know when we're coming.
And of course, you get the rub from being his partner, which is nice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it made me a star instant down there. You know, they started calling me. I forgot what Gaston. You ever heard the word Gaston? It's something down in New Orleans, down in the Cajun part. And they always told me, I said, y'all keep calling me Gaston. Who is Gaston? And they'd tell me, it's the alligator man in the swamp. I said, I remind y'all of the alligator man in the swamp. And they said, oh, yeah, you Gaston. I said, okay, I'm Gaston.
Well, I hope it's a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. They either liked you down there or they told you they didn't like you.
Yeah, which is we've heard so many stories, I think, from Jim Cornette as well, of fans and just, you know, how crazy some of those fans could be. So, Jerry, I'm going to take a left turn with my questioning right now, as I often do. All when right. we get on. We have a celebrity with us. And so my partner, Jeff Baudrin, is born in Tokyo. And he has been in South Florida now for some 35, 40 years, but he's moving to kind of your neck of the woods. He's moving to a suburb of Atlanta called Alpharetta. And the first thing we've got to do for Jeff is we've got to figure out where we're going to be able to feed this boy. So when Jerry Stubbs goes out to dinner, and I got it. First thing I'm going to ask, do you go out for barbecue? Because barbecue is a favorite of ours. Where would you go locally to get good food or good barbecue in the area?
Well, if you go, I don't know a whole lot about Alpharetta, but I mean, you're going to find a good barbecue place because there's not any bad eating places in Alpharetta. You'll get barbecue, you'll get good steaks, you'll get good chicken. You get all the good food that, you know, that we wish we could get on this end of the town, but we don't. Some of those restaurants we don't have. But they don't have, when you get to Atlanta, there's a thing on TV that says Atlanta Eats, and it tells you the good spots to go. I would listen to that. I'd go in on my email or my app or whatever and look at AtlantaEats.com, and I'm telling you, there's so many good places to go in Atlanta, and Alpharetta to Atlanta. When you go a little bit south, we get a few of them, but we don't get the great ones. And in Alpharetta, they get all the great ones. So there's not a bad place.
Jerry, let me ask you, when you go not all the way up to Alpharetta, but just into Atlanta, have you ever had a chance to go to a place called Fox Brothers Barbecue?
Say that again.
Fox Brothers Barbecue?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Oh,
Fox Brothers,
man.
Is big down here, too.
Yeah, that is some good food right there, boy. And I plan to be a regular there, I'll tell you that. Which means I'm probably going to pack on a good 40 pounds. I'm sure I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, they have good, some home cooking stuff, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Jerry, I have another question. Jerry, do you eat a lot of pizza? Do you like pizza?
Yeah, I like pizza. Matter of fact, we just got through eating pizza at Godfather's.
There you go. So this is my question, Jerry. This has been a big topic of conversation within our Facebook group. But whenever we have a guest on, some people like to put pineapple on pizza, Jerry. Quite frankly, I'm not a fan of that. What does the great Jerry Stubbs think of pineapple on pizza?
No, I got to have my regular pizza. I either got to have a supreme with extra cheese and some more pepperoni on it. And that I don't have no pineapple. If I want a pineapple, I fixed me a pineapple sandwich. Now, pineapple sandwich with a little mayonnaise on the bread, that's a heck of a sandwich.
Really? I've never heard of that one before.
I've never heard of that either.
Yeah.
Breaking kayfabe on pineapple sandwiches here, Jerry.
Yes, sir. You need to try that one. That's a good one. Sure is.
So let me ask you a question now. Let me go back to somebody that you mentioned just a couple minutes ago, and that's Mr. Wrestling 2. So one of the other things that's on YouTube that's available for the folks, and I'll post a link on our Facebook page, is the tremendous angle that was done with you and Mr. Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker. It involved some items of Johnny's that were destroyed in his suitcase or were in your suitcase. Why don't you tell us about the genesis of that angle and what you remember about that whole time slot in that time period when you and Johnny Walker had some heat with one another on TV.
Right. Well, what we did, Bill Watts came to me and he said, look, Gary, he said, we got two masked men coming. He said, I need to do something with one and I may have to move one. I said, okay. I said, well, why don't you turn me heel against Wrestling 2? And I'm jealous because he's coming in and he's getting all the glory. And I'm not getting none. And, you know, he's the other masked man. And then I start to do things to him. And sooner or later, he catches me and confronts me. And we do this big deal and so on. And he said, I don't know. Let me think about it. So he had to think about it to make sure it's his. You know what I'm saying?
He makes sure so he gets full credit.
He wanted to make sure he said, okay, I've been thinking about that. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But it wasn't like, we're going to do what you want to do, but it was mostly what I'd been talking about. So we did the deal and so on and so on. And then me and Ted started teaming up against him and Chavo Guerrero and several more. Tiger Conway. That was another one. So we had some good runs with those guys, you know. And one night we had a big free-for-all in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Me and Ted DiBiase against Wrestling 2, and Ted did something, screwed Mr. Wrestling 2. And, boy, they hit the ring, man. We got out, and all the security guards left. Believe it or not, they left us. They did not help. And we got the wrestlers coming from the back. We hit the fairgrounds in Tulsa. And Ted got bit one of his fingers. The guy bit one of his fingers almost off. We had to go to the hospital that night. And so on and so on. So, hey, it got rough sometime, man. But I'm telling you, the more it got rough, the more money we make.
So in the Mid-South Territory, it's, you know, Jim Cornette on his show has talked about the fans, some of the notorious places in the Mid-South area for fans. Where did you find the worst fans? Was it, you know, Tulsa? Was it Louisiana? Where was it?
My worst fans is New Orleans, because once I turned on Junkyard Dog, man, I had people trying to kill me. You know, so I think that was one of my worst spots. And the other spot was when I was over in Southeastern with Ron Fuller and that group was Mobile. It was kind of like the same as New Orleans. I don't, you know, same kind of people, same kind of atmosphere or whatever. But when I turned on Junkyard Dog, I'm telling you, I had to fight my way back. You know, and every time I went to the ring, I had to fight my way there to get there just to work, you know. So,
well, like was, you said, though, you're getting paid. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man. And I tell them, too, man, I'm going to make some more money. Y'all just keep coming, because I'm going to knock one of you out each time you come up. You know, so it was fun, you know. And I wasn't a big brawler in my day, you know. I was a small guy coming up in high school. I weighed about 145. But as soon as I got into the wrestling business, I got, you know, more and more. But at 145, I'd fight you in a heartbeat, you know. And that was some of my problem in high school. I'd fight you in a heartbeat. Don't cross my path, and me and you gonna have it out. So I got a lot of trouble back then, but I was a go-getter and a fighter. So I think that helped longer, you know, later on in the years. I think that helped.
So one of the other things too that the Bill Watts territory was known for were these insanely long road trips, where you might be traveling from city to city, several hundred miles. So did you have a regular traveling partner? And what did you guys do to pass the time? You know, if you're going 600 miles, you guys are, you're probably having fun. And I've heard some of the stories about from some of the guys. So who did you hang with? Who did you travel with? And any good road stories you can share with us?
The most, me and Dog, we travel mostly. Bill Watts sold him a Mercedes that he had, almost gave it to him. And Dog didn't like to drive. So he'd say, hey, O, he called me O. Mr. O, come here. You want to drive? He said, look, let's go work out as soon as we can in the morning, and we'll go eat, and we'll take off, and we'll go to the show. You drive, I won't charge you any trans or any, you know, any money or whatsoever. And I drove because I didn't mind driving, you know. I was used to driving. So we'd do that, and we'd make all these shots and so on and so on. And a lot of times when we had stay over, we stayed in the same room with each other. And, you know, Dog was in, you know, his family was everything to him. And when when he was going to see his daughter graduate, you know, and he flipped that, his car and all that and died, man, it just tore me up. Because I remember a lot of times he said, I'm going to make sure I see her graduate. I'm going to make sure I see her get married. You know, he always said that. And that just tore me up back then, you know. And other than that, I kind of, there might be several people I'd get in there and say, hey, can I ride with y'all tonight or ride with y'all or whatever. But most of the time it was just Dog in that area.
So let me ask you, just so we can put this in context for people that haven't seen a lot of Mid-South and aren't familiar with the legend of JYD, especially in the New Orleans area. So you're driving in the car with him. Just how incredibly over was that guy in that area?
Oh, Dog would talk about it. He said, you know, what's that? He talked to me about, what do you think I ought to do tonight? I said, Dog, you just keep doing what you've been doing. Don't you hear them people talking? Don't you hear them people hollering, screaming? JYD, don't you hear that when you play that bad to the bone? They said, I said, well, I go out with you. I got chill bumps, so I know how they feel. He said, you think so? You think I said, no, hey, I'll get the match started. I'll get it going, this, that, and the other. You come in and do what you normally do, is destroy whoever's there, and we'll keep moving. And he said, okay, I'll let me think. Are you sure that's right? And I'd say, that's right. Hey, that's what we're going to do tonight. You know, just trust me. And we go out. When we get through, he'd say, yeah, you had it right, man. You had it right. I appreciate it.
But besides that, I'm really referring to like his celebrity status. So like, you know, you talked about, oh, we're going to go work out and then we're going to go have some breakfast somewhere. I mean, mm-hmm. Could he in that area really go out in public and not be inundated with fans, or was he able to just kind of blend in?
Several places we went to was kind of rough because everybody wanted an autograph and everybody wanted to see JYD. But we did a lot of things. Like when we worked out at Foxy's gym in New Orleans, we'd go early. We'd be there at 5 o'clock. So we didn't have a lot of people that were, you know, bothering us or whatever. And he'd like to then go eat early and so on. There'd be a few people, you know, that recognize him. But if we stopped somewhere along the way, it didn't matter where it was, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Mississippi, there's a bunch of them that knew who he was.
Well, so one of the things that interests me also is you were actually one of the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champions when you won the title from Les Thornton January 1981. And the lineage of that title is, in my opinion, that's one of the most important titles I think ever in professional wrestling, based off of the quality of wrestlers who held it. And for years, that was kind of known as the Danny Hodge title, you know, and obviously one of the greats of all time. And then it was Danny Hodge and Hiro Matsuda and a guy like Les Thornton, also just a tremendous, tremendous wrestler. What was it like, you know, being in the ring with a guy like Les Thornton, who was a ring general, trained in the British style of professional wrestling?
Oh, it was so, so easy. So going, when I got the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, I looked good. If you could look back where pictures and all that stuff, I looked real good at that point. I only weighed about 220, 225, and I was well built, had a good tan, had a little hair back then, and my body looked good and so on. And I went with him. I went with a guy named Dickie Steinborn, you know, Les Thornton, and so on and so on. Even the world champion, Nelson Roll. I worked with all those guys, you know. And back then, I just had it going for me. I just knew that, hey, man, give it to me. Just let me run with it. Just put me in the middle of the card and let me go. And that's what they did. And I had a good run through that. And then eventually I got a little heavier, a little outgoing, and had to change my appearance.
So, well, let me ask you, you know, you talk about all the guys that you wrestled with, that you dealt with, you know, talking about JYD. So after you leave Mid-South, I know you go eventually down to Southeastern and right. As Mr. Olympia, and they hook you up with a young wrestler just starting to make his way, who they believe called Super Olympia when he first came down there. Tell us about the formation and as the development that you saw as the tag partner of Marty Lundy, who we know as Arn Anderson.
Right. Well, we were over in Louisiana, and Marty was looking for a place to go, and him and a little referee that they had that he wanted to bring with him. He was living with his grandmother, and his grandmother finally passed away. And I said, come on out here. And so I got him to book out there with Ole and so on, and we worked. It was Marty Lundy and so on, and we worked out. And I told him one day, I said, I'm going back to Southeast. And I said, when you get through over here, why don't you come over there and we'll call you a Super Olympia. And you can be my partner and we'll do this, that, the other. And later on, we'll do something else. But that would be a good start. And I'm bringing you in as Super Olympia. And then later on in there, we turned against each other and people just, I mean, they just went wow. And then eventually me and him teamed up as partners, and had a heck of a run with all the tag team people, Robert and Jimmy Golden, Ron Fuller, Bob Armstrong, Brad Armstrong, the Armstrongs, and we had a heck of a run. And then, you know, we did a deal where he lost the mask and so on, and then he went and done his thing, and then I brought him in as my partner, and we had a heck of a run, like I said. And then later on, we had a loser leave town, and I actually left and had to go to Japan. And when I got back, I put a mask on and come back as Mr. Olympia, which people knew who I was. But he couldn't say, hey, you got to go because you lost and you got to go, because that was my deal. You know, everybody knew me as Mr. Olympia, and that's what I'm going to stay. And me and him had a big run then.
But just a guy that I'm sure you could see had all the talent in the world and just needed, you know, some experience and stuff like that.
Oh man. Hey, smooth. Anderson was as smooth as they come. And just like people used to tell me, I knew you could do it because I just watched you, you know? And that's the same thing with me. I watched
And quite frankly, at the beginning of our show, before we started recording with you, Jerry, I was talking to Barry, and I said, you know, your tag team with Arn Anderson, I thought, was probably one of the most underrated tag teams of the 80s. You know, people think about great tag teams like, you know, the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express, you know, all those teams that came through the 80s. And your team in Southeast was absolutely phenomenal. And it's a shame that you guys couldn't get a national gig as a tag team, because I thought you guys were really good.
Well, I appreciate that, you know, because we thought we were, but we never got that recognition. And finally, when we did, when Ric Flair recognized it and so on, I had the blood clot. So Arn got to go to New York. Of course, at that time, we were close to our end of our era, because we're getting older, you know, and so on and so on. And our body was taking a beating. But yeah, man, that was our time, and we just never got it.
Gotcha. So, Jerry, in your career too, you were really successful as both a heel and a babyface. And did you have a preference? And a lot of times, when we ask guys that question, the immediate response is, "Oh, I loved being a heel. I loved that." Oh, yeah. How about you? Yeah. How do you fall into that as well? Or
Oh yeah. That's the fun of it. You get the people up, you get them excited, you get them riled up, you get them saying what they want to say. Just holler and scream if you want to. That's why I want you to come out here, you know. You pay your money, holler and scream at me. I want you to scream at me. The more booze I get, the better I know I'm over. And so on and so on. And man, being a heel, I was a good one. There's some things that I shouldn't have done when I was a heel because I made them so mad. And some of the things people said, you shouldn't have said that. I had one guy one night, he was in a wheelchair. I hate to say it, he was in a wheelchair. He was screaming, he was hollering, he was throwing things at me, this, that, and the other. And I got the mic, and I went over there, and I said, look, you know, I'm tired of you screaming, you hollering, all that. But if you can't stand up and say that to me, then I don't need you saying nothing, you know. And I felt bad after I said it, but, you know, you say things to get them excited and get them hollering and screaming and other people hollering and screaming behind them. Felt bad about it, but you know, all in the end, they know I didn't mean it.
So I feel like I need to ask you, you know, you talk about all the guys you worked with in Southeast. One of the guys that we really love talking about on the show as just being, in my mind, criminally underrated, was the late Brad Armstrong. And also out there on YouTube for the folks to see, there's a great sequence where you, wearing the hood and as Mr. Olympia, and I want to say this is towards the latter part of the 80s, have a match where you lose the hood to the Bullet, Bob Armstrong. Tell us your memories of working with Bob Armstrong and what a great talker that guy was, and Brad, who was so phenomenal in the ring.
Brad was one of the best. I worked with him and his other brother, Scott. And Scott was, you know, he referees in WWF now. But Scott was a good one, but Brad was the best. And we just had phenomenal. I mean, we could go night after night after night, 30, 40, 45 minutes. It wouldn't matter to us. We just enjoyed. But Brad was one of the best. Now, Bullet Bob, he was the master of all the boys, you know. He was the best. Me and him had some matches that you just wouldn't believe, but we had a loser leave one night, we had a loser has to take the mask off. Of course, we knew he was Bullet Bob, but everybody wanted to see me take my mask off, you know, and so on and so on. So we did, and I lost the match and whatever, but when I pulled it off, I had one underneath. And they just went wild. They just went crazy, crazy, crazy. And we had another 2 weeks later, we went back and had a rematch and so on, and said, I can't wear one underneath. I only got one mask. And then they pulled it off, and yet, you know, we pulled me out of the ring, and they covered my face and all that. But, you know, it's funny because they all knew who I was, you know, and so on. But they just wanted that mask off my head. And so sooner or later, when they got it off, they went nuts and so on and so on. Then I started being a heel as Jerry Stubbs, worked with a Dirty White Boy, Tony Anthony. And now me and him, we had a good team.
Yeah, another guy was a great hand.
Yeah, he was real good. We had a great team, and we had a go at it for a while. And you know, that kept me down there in the southeastern area longer than I figured I'd ever stay, because I had a run as a babyface. I had a run as a Jerry Stubbs, as Mr. Olympia, Jerry Stubbs again, and so on and so on. And I stayed for years, until everything just kind of folded up.
So, well, let me ask you, Jerry, as we begin kind of wrapping up, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time here tonight. I did hear a story that I want to talk to you about, and that was about a meeting that you had with a young Kurt Hennig where you gave Kurt an idea for a gimmick. Can you tell us about talking to Kurt about Mr. Perfect?
Oh, yeah. We were in Japan. Me and Kurt was in Japan. He was going and so on and so on. And Kurt liked to drink now. He liked to drink. And we'd get to go out with the Japanese people, and they would take us down to this place or that place. And all the girls would come over and sit with us at the table, and we would drink whatever. And he loved, bourbon. He loved that bourbon that he got, and it cost $100 a bottle now. And they didn't care. They get it. Hey, you want another bottle? You drink another bottle. So he was saying, you know, I got to go back to New York, and I got to figure out something that I can do, or I probably won't be there long. You know, they won't use me much. I got to have a gimmick. And I said, well, Kurt, I've used it just a couple of times. I said, why don't you go ahead and call yourself Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, and get you some stuff that kind of matches the outfit and do this, that, and the other. And he said, well, you don't mind? You don't want to use it? I said, look, it don't look like I'm going nowhere here but Japan, you know. I said, so take it back with you and try to make some money with it and do your best. And so he did. And they called him Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect. And I watched him a lot, you know, and I didn't mind at all.
Gotcha. And Jerry, was that when you were working in Japan as a sheik?
Right. I was a sheik. Me and Tiger Jet Singh, he got me there. And one day he said, look, I need a partner. Why don't you shave your head and go as our sheik, because I had a beard, and use a turban and all that. And he said, I'll get you booked several times during the year. And I did. I got 8, 10, 12 times if I wanted. And we'd go and we'd work I went as a sheik and he went as Tiger Jet Singh. And that little thing he carried around, that little thing on the end that has the ball, boy, he'd whoop you in a minute. So I just followed him, boy, and he'd tear him up and we'd do our thing. Hey, I got pretty big over there.
So, Barry, so you want to tell the folks about some place where Jerry's going to be appearing in the near future?
Yeah, absolutely, too, Jeff. And I was just pulling that up, too, so you can meet Jerry Stubbs. And I know I'm going to try to get there. But Jerry Stubbs is going to be appearing with Sean Royal, who was a guest on our show last week, the One Man Gang, and Boris Zukov, and it's going to be on Saturday, August the 17th at The Gathering. This is one of the largest wrestling fan fest conventions that I've ever seen. I think there's something like 70, 75 of the boys there. So this is definitely one of the biggest events I've ever seen anywhere. And our old friend Nick Massey of Captain's Corner is bringing in, again, Jerry Stubbs, Sean Royal, One Man Gang, Boris Zukov. I'm excited for this one, too, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to get there. Jeff and I have been talking about it, but how much do you like going to the fan fest and getting to meet everybody who supported you all those years ago?
Oh, man, it's great. And to see the boys like Boris and several of them that I hadn't seen, it's great. a one-man game. I hadn't seen him since we did a little fan fest in New Orleans back with Bill Watts and some other people. So that it's been a long time, you know. But these are guys that, you know, really was – when I was in my prime, they're the ones just I looked at and said, hey, man, you know, I'm just proud to be on the same card as some of these guys. But, yeah, the one-man gang, Barsukov, old Bars, he's something else. I hadn't seen him in a long time. Last time I seen him, he was in Dothan, Alabama. And I told him, I said, I got to drive to Atlanta, which is 4 hours. And he said, no, man, just stay with me. I got an extra bed over here. Just stay with me, get up in the morning, go, you know, you don't have to. So I said, man, I appreciate that. And I stayed with him. That's the last time I seen Bars. So I'm going to be glad to see Bars this time.
Well, one of the things that Barry likes to say here, and I certainly can't agree enough with it, is that, you know, when you get a chance to meet these guys at these fan fests, guys that when you were younger, that were the object of your affection and cheers, or that you booed the hell out of because they were heels. When you get a chance to go meet these guys, just absolutely go, because it's nothing like it. And taking a few minutes, and whether it's just getting an autograph or a photo opportunity, shooting the breeze with these guys, it's loads and loads of fun, and you always have a good time.
Well, you know, and bring up some stories. You know, hey, I heard this, I heard that. Hey, do you remember this? Do you remember that? Because, I mean, as we get older, we forget a lot of stuff. But if you'll bring back to the memory, then we say, oh, man, yeah, I remember that. You know, let me tell you about that. You know, there was one incident with me. I don't know how much time you got. I'll rush through.
No, you're fine.
There was a time we were in Charlotte, matter of fact. Me, Wahoo McDaniel, Andre the Giant. We went to this place, and Wahoo took us, and he said, okay. We went up to the door, and the glass is kind of colored. You know what I mean? It's painted. So and he knocks on the door, and somebody comes to the door, and they say, okay, Wahoo, y'all come on in. We go in there, and there's all kind of gambling machines. Gambling this and gambling that and blackjack and so on and so on and so on. So we ended up playing. I ended up winning $500 that night. And I said, man, I'm scared. You think I'm going to get out of here okay? So and we got Andre. He bet a man $200 that he could get all them balls. We did. Wahoo bet him. And he could get all them balls in one corner pocket. And the guy said, he said, put your money up. He put his money up. Andre picked up the pool table, turned it to the corner, and all them balls run in one pocket. And he grabbed the money, and the old guy's face was just, I mean, he was stonewalled, man. He just looked like, oh my God, you know. So on it happened.
So I know everybody that's been out on an evening with Andre has an Andre story, because that's just something. There's a seemingly never ending supply of great Andre stories. Well, hey, listen, Jerry, we want to say on behalf of Barry and myself how much we appreciate you taking some time out here of your day and reminiscing a little bit about your days in Mid-South and Southeastern, Mid-Atlantic, all over the place. And we really do appreciate you. And we want to give a special thanks to Nick Massey for hooking us up with you. And so thanks so much. We hope the fans will come out to Charlotte and see Jerry Stubbs, Mr. Olympia.
Yeah, it's not just me. You know, come out and see us all, because, you know, not many times you get to see that many, and you don't know who's going to be around the next time.
Well, I'm trying to put you over as the main event there, Jerry.
Well, I always kind of put the other guys in main event. I'm just underneath them, and then I go out and I try to prove I'm better.
There you go. Well, we appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thank you.
Okay, next question, Barry, comes from Mark Hertweck. I always mess up Mark's name. With a special shout-out to Stephen Knuth, who asked a similar question. Barry, if you could rebook one match in history, what would it be? And if you were the referee, you know, how would you work at the finish out that you'd change it?
And I saw that question, too, and I remember Stephen actually reached out to me and wanted to know, did we use his question on the first episode? And I said, no, but I can guarantee we'll get to it on the second episode. I'm not really sure what I would rebook. There's probably a bunch of matches in the NWA with Dusty Rhodes, where he was making a lot of these decisions, in the, you know, that 1986 era, that, you know, where some of those decisions were extremely, you know, the dusty finish was a huge part of that. I don't know. I'm not sure which specific match I would completely rebook. Is there something?
I've got
that,
one for you.
That you've, okay, let's hear it.
How about the finger poke of doom? Goldberg and Hogan?
Yeah.
In you hindsight, what a tremendous idea that was.
I don't even count that shit. Like when the finger poke, which really that's one of the more embarrassing things in my with professional wrestling. But there was that. There was the Jeff Jarrett lay down for Hogan kind of thing. That stuff was, you know, there's so
Lou
many
reminding me that
involved.
That was Nash and Hogan. So shout out to my boy Chris Zaha for the Kevin Nash reference we are making in the show today.
Yeah,
it
was. But the other one was Jarrett and Hogan, where Jarrett just went in and laid down. And that shit was so embarrassing to professional wrestling on so many different levels. I don't even think of that as like something that should have been rebooked because it was just a big steaming pile of shit from the get go. So,
well,
you know,
here's another thing that I remember about that time period is they had done all that work to build up Sting as the Crow. Hanging up in the rafters and stuff like that. And they bring him in and it's all set up. And what is it set up for? For good to conquer evil, which is every single wrestling storyline over the last 50 fucking years. And they have Sting, like they don't give Sting the win. And I remember thinking, do they not understand that wrestling is like a Western? You know, the good guy wins at the end. You know, otherwise, the good guy doesn't get fucked at the end. That's stupid. And, you know, that era. And now they've made the guy the head of SmackDown, but I digress.
Exactly. So, that era was such a cluster. It was such an insult to professional wrestling fans. And granted, we've been shit upon for years by Vince McMahon on a weekly basis and other wrestling companies. But what was taking place there was it was beyond illogical. And it was a weekly insult. You know, it's almost indescribable what a clusterfuck all that shit was that was taking place on a week, which was all based off of political bullshit. It was all based off of, can I keep this guy happy? And, you know, and this guy, I need to have my nose up, Hogan's ass. So I got to do this. When the truth is Sting would have been the guy drawing the money. Goldberg was, you know, take out whatever you think of Goldberg. That guy was over like a fucking $100 million right there. And they completely fucked that up. So I think you can go back and I think you can take this excellent question, which came from Mark Hertweck and Stephen Knuth, and you can say all of WCW while Eric Bischoff was there.
Yeah, okay. Second question from Mark. Barry, if you could only have one ethnic food for the rest of your life, what's it going to be?
One ethnic food. This is difficult because with the exception of the shit blaster known as Ethiopian food, I'd love everything else, Jeff.
Right? You're not going Ethiopian.
I'm not. I will never go. I'll never eat Ethiopian again because I never want to have explosive diarrhea at that kind of level. It's a tough one there because I do love my Mexican. I love Chinese. I love Italian tremendously. I don't think pizza qualifies as ethnic food, and I love it. So maybe I'm going to go in a different direction. I'm going to say sushi, and I'll tell you why. It is seafood, so it's Japanese, obviously, but it's seafood, which I love. But I've always said if I was a millionaire, I would go on some sort of sushi diet because it's fairly healthy. And I would love to start eating a little bit healthier. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that way. So I'll say sushi, but the truth is, you know, on any given day, Jeff, I wake up and it's like, man, I'm really in the mood for Chinese today or whatever it is. It's an excellent question, but it certainly, I would change my mind a lot. I'm going to say sushi today, though.
I'm going to say Italian. And I like your Chinese. I was going a different direction, but I think Chinese would be a good second choice there. So, all right. Our boy Chris Spiker wants to know, Barry, who's the best wrestler turned actor?
What does that mean though? Like, does it mean like, what are we the guy who was the best wrestler in the ring that turned into an actor?
Well, probably a guy that was a good wrestler that turned into an actor of some note, not a shit actor, like somebody that was decent as an actor.
Right. Right. I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, I could think of all the guys who have been wrestlers that made their transition into acting. Obviously you've got the most, you know, I think the Rock has transcended professional
wrestling.
Yeah,
I think that's
wrestling.
A pretty obvious first choice.
Yeah, exactly. But it's almost too obvious with that one. There have been some, you know, Hulk Hogan was never able to do it successfully.
No,
he was a
no,
horrific
was,
actor, yeah. terrible actor. Batista, say what you want to say about Batista.
No, that's a good, I hadn't included yeah. him, but that's a fair choice. He was very
never
good.
Thought in, he was, never
in the Guardians
he was
of the Galaxy
the ring.
Series.
Yeah, but you watch him in the movies. He's actually really good in the movies, though. He's a decent actor, much better than he was a wrestler. So
and here's the thing. Yeah. Have you seen the previews for the movie that he has coming out where he gets in the car with the guy that's the Uber driver? And here's what I love about it. It's because Dave Bautista is not taking himself so fucking seriously like some of these guys that, you know, and I really think that's a way of expanding his horizons. And I heard that he was offered a part in the next Fast and Furious movie. And he said, no, I just want to do good movies, which I think was a nice shot across the bow at Vin Diesel there. The other two guys that I thought were Piper made a great movie in They Live, which is a cult classic. And I really enjoyed him in that. Here's a guy from going back in the, like the 50s and 60s, always played a heavy, Mike Mazurki.
Yeah, so Mike Mazursky, and I think he was one of the founders of Cauliflower Alley Club, and he was in that movie, was it Night in the City?
Yes, with Richard Widmark.
That he was in, right, and so he did make a transition to Roddy Piper. So if Roddy Piper had, and look, you could even say Terry Funk. I mean, fuck, Terry Funk.
Oh, yeah,
Funk
no, absolutely. That's a good
one. Yeah, I was watching Roadhouse with my son who had never seen Roadhouse, Jeff, and I'm like,
what?
Exactly. And I was like, wait a minute. Wait till you see one of the bad guys getting out of the truck right here. And he goes, is that Terry Funk? It's like, you damn right that's Terry Funk. And Terry Funk obviously probably being the best wrestler of all the names that we just mentioned. Piper, though, with the exception of that movie, which is, you know, They Live is just such a good movie on so many different levels, he really never made another good movie again. So I'm going to back this up. I'm going to say Terry Funk.
Yeah, no, yeah, and I would say that I think on the Rose Family Vacation that's happening at this recording, I think that a little thing called Paradise Alley, Frankie the Thumper might be in young Zach's future to see. So anyway, okay, next question we got. Let's see here, coming up from Scott Keeler. Scott Keeler wants to know, Barry, if you were a wrestler, what's your entrance music?
So that's a good one right there too. And I'll tell you, for years, so I've already had this question in my head, I think for years. There was a song by the Pretenders called My City Was Gone, which has got a bass line to it. Dun, 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 dun. And I was like, that's kind of a badass song. It's kind of like a black leather jacket, slow strut to the ring. And then I found out that obnoxious asshole Rush Limbaugh was using that as his opening for his radio show for years. And I said, okay, so I could never use that. I do like the bass line, so I would stick with the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Higher Ground. So I wouldn't go the Stevie Wonder version, but I would go the Red Hot Chili Peppers version. There's a bunch of other songs, too. Iron Maiden. I could probably name five Iron Maiden songs. Motorhead. You know, that to me should be an entrance song, too. It should be kind of badass. There should be something about it. You know, sometimes I watch the WWE and I hear some of the entrance songs and I'm like, that doesn't strike fear in the heart of an opponent when you hear shit like that. But to me, an entrance song should be kind of tough. It should be kind of badass.
Yeah, that's why I always thought that, like, your class, and I'm not talking, you know, when you talk about the generic entrance music, you know, for every entrance music, like The Undertaker or Steve Austin's, you know, the glass shattering, there has been some really lame wrestling entrance music after the 80s. And the 80s had all the really good entrance music and stuff like that. Somebody posted on Twitter recently, what's your favorite entrance? And I couldn't believe it. Nobody mentioned friggin' Kerry Von Erich coming down to the ring in the Sportatorium to Tom Sawyer, for God's sakes. That was one of the great entrance songs. But if Jeff Bowdrin is coming down to the ring, I came up with a couple of choices here. I'm going to go Barry from a group called King's X. Music in My Head, which was a great song.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. How about Grand Funk Railroad? Little thing called Sin's a Good Man's Brother. You familiar with that song?
I'm not. No, I'm not. No.
Okay, so that's a good tune. So now here's one, Barry. I wouldn't necessarily call this a good song, because the song doesn't necessarily have to be good. It just has to have a good entrance. You know, good first 45 seconds, shall we say. Aldo Nova, Fantasy.
Yes. Fantastic.
Yes, okay. Next. From AC/DC, because we got to have an AC/DC song in there, let's be honest. And, you know, in my recently released book, They Call Me Booker by Jeff Bowden, available at Crowbar Press.
Wait, hold on. Where can we get this book, Jeff?
That's available at crowbarpress.com, my good friend Scott Teal. Or you can contact the author, as happened today. Thank you, Peter Rosario. So I, in my book, thought that a great entrance song for the great Jushin Thunder Liger would be AC/DC song Thunderstruck. Good idea, Bear?
Yep, very great idea.
Yeah, I like that. Last, or I want to say last. I got two, actually. Have you ever heard of the group Wolf Mother?
I have heard of Wolf Mother.
They got a song called Colossal, which the entrance to Colossal is really good. Last one, Barry, going to go Queen, I Want It All. I think that'd be a great entrance song for a heel. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess it would have to be like an aristocratic heel, like a Steve Regal or a guy with fancy robes, because you hear Freddie Mercury, and again, look, he's probably the greatest rock vocalist in the history of rock and roll, but he's just not badass, though. just hitting the certain notes is not really badass, but I think if you get like a British guy, you know, yeah, it could be. I think it would play well in Japan, too, I think. Something like that, you know, for a British guy in Japan would play extremely well.
Yeah. So Will Ospreay coming to the ring with I Want It All. That'd be good stuff. Yeah. So did I credit? I'm not sure I credited. That was Scott Keeler that asked that question. Okay. Next, Shar Johnson wants to know, Barry, what do you think is the best rock documentary ever?
Oh, so are we going with a full out rock documentary? Could it be the mockumentary? Could it be This Is Spinal Tap?
There you go.
Yeah.
That's a great choice.
Yeah, loved it. Rock doc, and there's a shitload on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
They were doing it a month or two ago, and there was
perhaps a future movie of the week, Barry. One of the rock documentaries.
There were like 30 of them that were on. So they do special theming every month, and this was about all rock documentaries. My favorite is probably Erg, A Music War, which really wasn't a documentary as much as it was just specific performances from punk and new wave artists and reggae artists in the early 80s. And I've talked about this a few times, whether soundtracks or movies, whatever it might be. But man, Spinal Tap. Remember the first time seeing Spinal Tap? I think laughed my ass off.
Yeah. This one goes to 11. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm going to say right off the top of my head, I'm going to go Pink Floyd's The Wall. Love the Beatles' Let It Be, even though it was basically about a band disintegrating, but I still love that. A very polarizing band, but a great documentary that was recently on Showtime about 2-3 years ago about the history of the Eagles, which was a 2-part documentary.
Yeah.
And holy crap, was it great. And it showed what a complete piece of shit Glenn Frey and Don Henley are. I mean, they're great musical artists, but ooh, really dirt bags. So, let's see what we got next here. Keon Vidotti wants to know, Barry, and I think this is something we can easily talk about as a movie we have recently reviewed. What movie is so bad that it's good?
Turf. Keon, do you listen to the show? You know, 99% of the movies I've chosen, if they're not documentaries, they would be considered trash film. Whether it's Savage Streets, Tough Turf, Streets of Fire, you know, that's kind of what are my genre, and I think I've sucked Jeff in a little bit with this one. I love them all. I got to admit, Savage Streets has, you know, we talk about Linda Blair's breasts every week, and Savage Streets has kind of got me transfixed, because I have gone back and watched it a second time, and I think even enjoyed it more the second time. If you were going to ask me what is my favorite pure trash movie in the history of trash movies, it is Angel, and it is the 1984-85 classic with Donna Wilkes, where she plays a high school student by day and prostitute at night. Dick Shawn as a transvestite. Is that an appropriate word still? Transvestite? Can we say that?
In transition, let's just say that.
In transition, okay. But Dick Shawn, who was a great comedian, somehow somebody had the foresight to dress him up as a woman, and he plays a transsexual, transvestite, in transition prostitute. And the movie is just John Deal from Miami Vice and a million other movies, Falling Down.
Stripes.
He plays the serial killer. What was the other one?
John Deal was in Stripes.
In Stripes, absolutely. Yeah. Stripes. He was, one of the farm boys.
Yeah.
He's a great character actor. A really bright guy and a movie director as well, which by the characters he's played, you would never realize. But
I like fast cars and fast women. Remember that line from Stripes? I like fast cars and fast women. That's why they call me the cruiser.
Yeah, that's right. That's when they're all sitting around the big toe, Mr. Sergeant Holka, the big toe. Yep.
So, okay, I'm going to give my choice for best bad movie or movie so bad that I love it. And Barry, by God, we have to review this movie 1 week just so we can trash the movie like we did Tough Turf last week. And that is 1980s Urban Cowboy with John Travolta and Deborah Winger. Good Lord, that is gloriously bad. And so much, it's so easy to make fun of that movie because Travolta is a cowboy. I don't know how that that idea came around, but it's hilarious. Great soundtrack, but he's just hilariously bad in that movie. Okay, Barry, next, Sean McIver wants to know, Barry, what's your worst vacation ever?
Oh, my worst vacation. I got to be honest. When I saw that come through in my head, I read some of these questions. I didn't read all of them, but I saw that one and I'm thinking, have I ever had a really, really bad vacation? I don't think I ever really had a horrible vacation. I will say my honeymoon was spent on the island of St. Lucia. And it was we had a full week and the sixth day was great. And then I got sick and it was, I think I could trace it back to prosciutto, some sort of pork product, but I don't know that to be fact. And I spent, 24 hours as sick as any human being could be out of every, there was a hole in my body, Jeff, there's just shit flying out of it, literally. And then the next day I had to get on a plane, and this wasn't a plane like a jumbo luxury jet. I should say we had to take a Jeep over a rocky road to the airport, which was a 2-hour drive. Then I had to sit on it's a small plane, and my seat was pretty much where the engine was on the small plane. And this was taking us to Puerto Rico, where we would actually catch a bigger jet to get home. And I just remember thinking, you know, if it ends right now, I'll be okay. Like, I was so miserable. Like, I've lived a life. This is fine. Let's just fucking end this right now. I was so miserable. And I got home and I was still sick for a month, where I was still having issues. And I had some sort of bacterial, it wasn't a flesh eating bacteria, but it was some sort of bacterial parasite in my, stomach. This was, 1998. So that, I guess that would, it was great the beginning half, but man, those last couple of days, that it just was fucking nightmare.
Well, I'll tell you, since you referenced your honeymoon, I will tell you a story about, my honeymoon with Mrs. Bowder. Not my worst vacation ever, but it could have been because Mrs. Bowder and I went out to Vegas. We stayed at Caesar's Palace. So we take a drive out to Red Rocks Canyon. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so Mrs. Bowder now referencing what I'm about to reference. So we go out there and we're looking around, enjoying the beautiful Red Rocks Canyon. So we go and there's a point where you can, you know, the scenic shot where you, oh, take your picture here. So we go there. So we're, of course, driving a rental car out in Vegas. And so we get out of the car to take the photo opportunity. And apparently the car was not put in park. The car begins to roll and there's a bit of a cliff. So we begin running towards the car and hold on a second. Who jumped in the car? Me or you? Okay. My wife jumps in the car to grab the, because you know, I'm not going down. I'm a real man's man. Honey, you get in the car and stop the car. She grabs it, you know, pulls the emergency brake, stops the car. And all I'm thinking is, you know, how the fuck, if this happened, was I going to explain to everyone I knew that my beautiful bride just drove the fuck off a cliff in Red Rocks? So, yeah, that was my favorite part of the whole weekend. That would have had me looking for wife number four, And at that point, I think I would have been fully established as a loser and a potentially a black widower. So, okay, next question. Good question, Sean. Comes from, John Paul Manganelli. He wants to know, Barry, what wrestler's death impacted you most personally?
So it's going to be a twofold answer. Overall, Billy Robinson. So, you know, no secret. I was the president as a 12-year-old of the Billy Robinson fan club. And to me, he was a god. He was a wrestling god. I had never seen a wrestler with the repertoire and the moves that he had. And I became very friendly with him. My father was very friendly with him. Actually sent me postcards from Japan, which I still have to this day. And I didn't see him. And I know I've told this story. I didn't see him for some 25, 30 years. And I actually saw him at a wrestling convention. And I went up to him. And I don't look anything like I did when I was a kid, obviously. And I put the photo that we had taken together in front of him. And he looks at it and he goes, Barry, like he remembered my name 30 years later. And he said, Barry, he goes, what happened to your hair? So we talked for a little bit and we exchanged phone numbers, and he said he was going to be in the Philadelphia region and we would get together. And as it turns out, we never did, and he died. And I got to tell you, when I found out that he died, I cried my eyes out that day. I literally cried my eyes out. It was a real piece, a real positive piece of my childhood, that had just been shut. And I was just really, I think I was sad that I never got to see him again. I was grateful for the fact I was able to reconnect after all those years, but it hit me really hard. And I think because he is so important to me as a kid, and then, you know, so, and his kindness to me as a kid too, which just, you know, was just off the charts. So it did hit me hard. The other one was somebody that I wasn't personally connected to, but somebody that I had really great memories of my childhood, and that was Wahoo McDaniel. And the only time I think I ever truly ever spent any time with Wahoo was when they did the CAC in Tampa in 1996, and I actually got to sit next to him at the banquet, and I talked to him all night, and I'm sure I was completely like an idiot, just completely marking out, but you know, that was such a great era in championship wrestling from Florida, that 1978 time frame when he was in, and I was going with Pete Lederberg and Brian Berkowitz three times a week, you know, Miami, West Palm, and Lauderdale, and Wahoo was on all those cards. So it just, you know, it was just one of those things that just really kind of hit home.
Yeah, I'll say the two that come to mind for me, and I believe I've discussed this before, hearing that Owen Hart had died, and, you know, more particularly the way he died was very upsetting to me.
Sure.
And I've discussed that before on this podcast. Second, I would say probably Jack Briscoe, not because Jack, you know, was, you know, one of a sudden death or anything like that. But, you know, I had the chance to meet Jack at CAC, and I've told people before, you know, when you have somebody who's like, you know, when you're a kid and you have a sports hero. And Jack Briscoe was one of my sports heroes as a kid. You know, when I first started really getting into wrestling, he was a world champion. And here I got to meet, you know, the friggin' world champion of my youth, Jack Briscoe. And then later, as we're leaving, that was out in Vegas, when we're going back to the airport, and we ran into him and his wife, Jan. And he saw me, and he goes, hey, Jeff, how you doing? And that Jack Briscoe knew my name. Holy crap, Barry, was that a moment to pop at like a mark, you know, just, I was like, that was so cool that Jack Briscoe remembered my name. I don't care if it was a day later, he still remembered my name, by God. And so when we lost Jack, it was really a tough moment for me. So those are the two that I would say, Owen Hart and Jack Briscoe.
Yeah. And you know, you're 100% right with both too. Owen Hart was too. And I think, and so was Jack. I think, unfortunately with Jack, I think I had been, I don't want to say desensitized, which is, I don't know if that's even the right word, but unfortunately, I think we had experienced a lot of death in professional wrestling when Jack had passed. With Owen Hart, based off of the circumstances, I think that stuck, it's a really good point, it stuck around with me several days later. You know, there were still several days later where I think I was still bothered by his death. And, you know, there are, Eddie Guerrero dying, which is some 13, 14 years ago, that really bothered me as well. I was really, you know, I loved Eddie Guerrero, obviously the Chris Benoit thing, and I don't want to, you know, before all the details came out,
The ones in retrospect, Barry, that are really, you know, that really stick with you and bother you are the guys that die alone in the hotel rooms. Eddie, you know, Brian Pillman, and Kurt Hennig, you know, was away from his family. And that those to me are the ones that, you know, to know that these guys were, you know, they weren't surrounded by, maybe Jack might have been surrounded by his wife and family when he passed away. I don't know. But, you know, the guys that end up dying in a hotel room, to me, that's just so sad that we lose them that way. So, OK, next question. Good question, John. Chris Chenault wants to know, Barry, a bit of a controversial question here. Has there ever been heat between Barry and Jeff?
Wow. So I am going to tell this story. And when I saw this, this was immediately what went to my head. So I think the answer, Jeff, and correct me if I'm wrong, is once. And
let's see if it's the same thing I was going to reference.
Well, it's got to be. It's got to be. So there was an instance last year, which was actually wasn't podcast related at all. But this is the part, honestly. So I'm even going to backtrack a little bit. When you wrote that you considered me your brother in your book that you, which, and I posted a photo of it, it meant a lot, and it meant a lot because you did something last year that has only happened, I think, twice in my life. And I'm going to get a little sappy right now. So Jeff and I had a disagreement, and there was heat, but it was this wasn't like some boiling over, knocked out. You know, there was an issue between us.
Yeah, more like it was a misunderstanding. Is that
fair?
Yeah,
it was a misunderstanding. You had a viewpoint. I had a viewpoint. But the way you handled it really made all the difference in the world. And I think as far as our, and look, we're always going to be friends. There's never going to be a question about that, but the way you did it really was, you said something that night and you came out and you said, look, you know, I don't agree what I forget exactly. I don't agree, but I don't want this to ever cause an issue in our friendship. And when you said that, and you said it with such conviction in your voice, that it immediately, it just took me off guard immediately, because we've been kind of verbally sparring up until that point. You completely took me off guard. And in thinking about it, only one other person my entire life has ever said that to me. And anytime, you know, you have an issue, whether right or wrong, and I'm not sure anybody was right or wrong in our situation, but whether right or wrong, you know, most people either let it stew or, you know, whatever. You basically said, I want to solve this right now because I don't want there to be an issue in our friendship going forward. And that, you know, that's unbelievable. That is an absolute unbelievable thing. So, you know, the truth is, I'm sure that I irritate Jeff at times. I mean, you know, fuck, we're married in a sense. And I know that I irritate the shit out of my wife. So I'm sure that I do. But at the same time, I think, you know, we are family. And that's how we view this. And, you know, we don't look at things, I think, as podcast hosts. We look at it, you know, we look at it as friends and as family. So, yeah.
Well, you know, and I'll say thank you for those words. You know, I've kind of referenced before that when my second book came out, there was a disagreement between myself and someone who was a big part of my first book, someone whose name I've never mentioned on this show, never will mention the person's name on my show, which is really unfortunate because the guy for a long time was one of my best friends. I mean, for a good... Oh, good Lord, Barry, good 15-year run as like one of those guys that I texted with the way I do with you. Literally every day we would talk, you know, not just about wrestling, sports, music, all the stuff that you and I talk about. And we had a disagreement and it became extremely personal to him. It wasn't to me. I had to, you know, I tried to use intermediaries to reach out to him to say, hey, look, let's talk about this. Let's not just piss away a friendship that's lasted that long. And he had no interest in that. And I finally called him up and I said, look, I said, obviously we have a situation. Would you like to talk about this? And he said to me, no. And I said, and he said, no, he didn't want to talk about it. And I said, okay, fine. And then, of course, the funny thing was my wife at the time was working as a vendor at the hockey games here in South Florida that this person would go to. And my wife confronted him and said, are you ever going to call my husband and talk to my husband about whatever issue you two have? And he actually looked my wife dead in the face and said, well, no, we don't have a problem with one another. We're fine with one another, which was complete horseshit. And my wife knew it was complete horseshit, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have a problem with somebody, fucking, you know, man up a little bit and just, you know. So,
but
and
how many
to this,
people really, how many people really do that? And that's why.
No, again, and you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
You know,
nobody does.
The friendship is worth saving. And that's what probably disappointed me more than anything was that, you know, this guy didn't feel, and, you know, I've talked about it with some people. He really thought what the problem was a huge deal. I didn't think it was that big a deal, you know, so maybe I was minimalizing, you know, and not taking into account how he might have felt. But, you know, the fact that he wouldn't even talk about it to explain why he thought it was a big deal, you know, he didn't want to. So, OK, basically, fuck him. That's the way it goes. So next question from the same Christian Altberry. When you're out at a restaurant, you get yourself a fine steak at one of the thousands of restaurants that you worked at, primarily in the New York City area. Wasn't it Tavern on the Green? Barry, when you're at Tavern on the Green having a fine steak, are you asking for steak sauce, yes or no?
No, so not with a good steak. If it's a piece of shit steak, and I've referenced that I've had shitty steaks, like what was that Longhorn Steakhouse I went to?
Yes.
6-7 months ago, absolutely. I was that horse meat I was trying to douse in sauce to kill the flavor and the chewiness. But no, if you get a good piece of meat, I mean, you know, I had a tomahawk steak at a restaurant. Actually, you know, Chima, which I know you're a big fan of, if you've never had a tomahawk steak, it's fantastic. But that's actually a special that they're doing where it's part of the Rodizio. But, you know, why would you ever want to put sauce on a really, really great steak? Completely defeats the purpose, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you're right. If you go to an upscale steak place, a Morton's, a Ruth's Chris, something like that, trust me, you're not going to want to put sauce on it because it's going to be cooked to perfection and it's going to be a good steak.
Yeah.
And if you have to ask for steak sauce, that means they fucked up the steak. So yep. Thanks for those two questions, Chris. Okay, next question comes from Steven Javorski. Barry, Aldi grocery store, yes or no?
I'll say yes, and I've never been in one, but I've heard great things about them.
Yeah. Mrs. Baldwin and I went to an Aldi a few months back, and it was nice. You know, it's way away from our neighborhood, so we don't shop there regularly, but it was okay. Okay, next question comes from Steve Russum. Has podcasting rejuvenated your interest in wrestling, past and or current?
No, not at all. I don't think it is. It has had any impact. I'll say that I'm grateful when we discover certain matches like that tag match that we had a couple of weeks ago, which was just a phenomenal match. So I don't think it's, you know, it's rejuvenated me to the point where I'm spending hours on YouTube or, you know, on the network or something searching for matches at all. But there's maybe an appreciation because in being able to flesh it out and have these types of discussions and then read other people's viewpoints, it gives me maybe a different perspective, a different way to look at some of these matches.
I think to a certain extent it has kind of re-sparked me. I've mentioned on more than one occasion that I go through, I guess you could call them dead periods as a wrestling fan, you know, when things just aren't good. And, you know, it's funny here. The day before we recorded this was the introductory episode of Raw, when an introductory episode of Paul Heyman as your I don't know, what is it, your CEO of Raw, or I don't know what they call him, the general manager of Raw. And I watched it, and everyone was so excited about the fact that Paul Lee was going to do something with it. And there was this moment at the beginning of the show where one of the announcers said, oh, shit. And, yeah. You know, immediately on Twitter, oh, Paul Lee's in charge, or cursing on the air. And then I watched the rest of the show, and there was a segment, and I don't, good Lord, Barry, I think it might have been Baron Corbin and a young girl, and they were having an interview segment, and the girl was so obviously reading off cue cards and trying to convey, like, she, you know, and I was going, oh my God, who is this person? And Baron Corbin, and I said, it was so bad, it was almost laughable. And I go, this is not good. And, you know, then they had, later in the show, they had AJ Styles. I'm sure, you know, when you hear this episode, you're going to be saying, oh, that happened a couple of weeks ago, but it's fresh to me. The AJ Styles turn on Ricochet, which I thought was really well done. That whole thing was set up nice, but there were other parts in the show that were just cringeworthy to me. So, but well, now that being
there was one of the most cringeworthy segments ever, and that was the Mike Bennett, Maria Kanellis segment. I don't know if you saw that, where they were wrestling Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch, and Maria said, "Don't touch me, I'm pregnant," and then berated Mike Bennett, who's her husband. "You're not a man. How could you be the father of my children?" Completely just humiliated him. And they're married in real life. And history has told us, Jeff, a million times, if you add some sort of acrimony to a marriage on screen, a lot of that shit transpires off screen as well. Yeah, you know, couples that break up on screen, exactly.
Don't book your own divorce, right?
Yeah, exactly. So so when I saw that, I thought that was one of the worst segments I ever saw. I will say I absolutely loved the AJ Styles stuff at the end of the night, though.
Yeah, and then, of course, you had the thing at the beginning with Bobby Lashley and I don't watch it. Who's the guy that he was doing the angle with?
Braun Strowman.
Braun Strowman. Okay, I'm sorry about that. But they did the whole thing. And then throughout the whole show, oh, prayers to Braun Strowman and Bobby Lashley. I was like, and my wife was, she was in the room. And she looked, did they really get hurt? And I'm like, no. But it was just like so over the top ridiculous, you know. So, Mrs. Bowdrin watching Raw. So, okay, next, Matt Mann wants to know, favorite Samoan wrestler of all time, Barry?
Oh, favorite Samoan wrestler. Single or tag?
Oh, go ahead and pick one.
All right. I'm going to go with the original Samoans who were not Afa and Sika. It was a team. It was T.O. Taylor and Reno Tafuli. And they came into Florida in 1973. And I thought they were great. They were highly unique. They were really good. There is a guy currently, and I believe he's MLW, and it's Jacob Fatu. And this guy has got superstar written all over him.
Yes, Jim Cornette has mentioned him on his show as being a future star.
He's 100% right. This guy is, just it's only a matter of time until he's main eventing the biggest cards in the U.S. He's that good, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, I like your choice of the original Samoans, because I can remember when I first moved here, my dad had retired from the Navy, and the Samoans were at the Fort Lauderdale Armory against Kevin Sullivan and Mike Graham. So
Well, they had a couple of managers. They had Dandy Jack Crawford.
That's who I was going to say, Dandy Jack Crawford. Yeah. So yeah, I used to love the advertisements in the newspaper, the picture of Dandy Jack where he was on the phone. That just always just cracked me up.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Okay, next question comes from Rick Springetti. I hope I'm saying that right, Rick, or Springetti. Barry, who's your favorite top three Canadian wrestlers?
Oh, okay. So number one would be Joe LeDuc. Two and three wouldn't matter as much, but number one's got to be Joe LeDuc. I could put Owen Hart, and I'll go a Calgary version of Owen Hart, because I did think he was maybe one of the best of all time. Ivan Koloff. You don't think of him as Canadian, but he was. So Ivan Koloff is one. Mongolian Stomper, again, not from Mongolia,
by way of Calgary.
Right. So, that's probably who I would go with. But I think if we're talking current, it would have been more the current generation, more Owen Hart.
Yeah. And, you know, let's mention Brett. Brett certainly had, you know, he's a polarizing figure, but he had a great run as champion. And, Jericho and Omega, they both have their fans. Yep. And I'm trying to think some other guys that came out of Toronto. I know there was Billy Red Lions. I really like your Joe LeDuc take. I completely forgot about that. But he definitely belongs up there, the Canadian freight train.
Oh, yeah.
So Ryan Damon wants to know, it's a two-part question. Barry, what is the best non-wrestling sports moment that you've witnessed on television and the best non-wrestling sports moment that you've witnessed live?
Well, I don't know how to even answer that one. So the best
Better come up with an answer, because that's what we got to do here on the show.
So it's the best non-wrestling sports moment
that you've
ever witnessed.
First on TV.
On TV, the Knicks winning. It's definitely a Knicks. I'm trying to think which one meant the most. I think the Knicks, when they eliminated Chicago, which I think was what, 95? I think it was 95 when the Knicks eliminated Chicago in the playoffs. Because I wasn't there. That was a pretty big deal. And what was the other aspect of that question?
Best non-wrestling sporting event that you've ever witnessed live. like going
Rangers winning the Stanley Cup in MSG was that probably. And I think I've told that story. I had a brother of a friend who was a vendor. And at the same time, the Knicks were in the NBA Finals, the Rangers were in the Stanley Cup Finals. So he got me a job as a vendor just because they needed extra hands. So I got to be in the building when all this shit was taking place. That was a big deal to me.
So Mrs. Baldron, coming through with my my two answers here. First is the Cubs winning the World Series in 2016. Mrs. Baldron reminded me that I wept. I wept openly at that. So, and I'm proud enough to say I did, man. So, and my best live moment, I think, probably was that year when we went up to Wrigley Field. I'd been a fan of the Cubs for, good Lord, Barry, like over 40 years, had never witnessed a game in Wrigley Field. And I went and got to see him. And it was even more sweet because they played the St. Louis Cardinals, their hated rival. And we were there with friends who were Cardinals fan. And by God, I got to witness the Cubs live at Wrigley beating the Cardinals. How freaking sweet is that? Okay. I'm going to wrap this up, Barry. Just a couple more questions here.
Sure.
Oh, let's see. Fritz Grande, what movie has been your favorite movie review here on the show? Is this going to be time for another Linda Blair boobs reference?
I think so. My favorite, it's going to be one of the last two. It's probably going to be Savage Treats or Tough Turf. We really went to town on those two. And we actually, and as you mentioned, we forgot to read off the reviews for Tough Turf. We just had the banter between us, which was us totally fucking up. But we did a lot. And certainly a lot of this shit was on my shoulders. We did a lot of serious movies, whether they were, documentaries or just a movie that's really serious, and those are great. But when you can talk about pure trash and it's just a lot of fun, that's what this show is kind of built on. So I would say maybe the last two have been arguably my favorites.
Okay, my two, I'm going to go my review of Rear Window, because that's such an iconic movie that I love so much. And going back to episode one, Easy Money, because that's such a, the whole idea for this podcast came from Barry and I talking about Easy Money on the phone one day for 1 hour, throwing one-liners from that movie, out at each other. And then the putting the wedding cake in the plumbing van next to the toilet. It's just so great. Okay, Andy Toth, let's try to do these as rapid fire as we can, Barry. Andy Toth wants to know, Barry, what's your favorite Westerns? Give me like a top three Westerns or top five or something like that. See if you can bring them off
Hail,
topic.
Hail Rider.
Good choice.
Is probably right there. Let's see. Pale Rider. Silverado I really liked a lot.
That's a good choice.
Yeah.
Pale Rider, a retelling of Shane, by the way.
Yeah, Shane, which has been on cable a lot lately. Also a very, very good movie. I'll go with those two.
Okay. I'm going to throw out a few at you. Fast and Furious here, Andy. My number one Western of all time, of course, because it's in my personal top five list, is Unforgiven by Clint Eastwood. I think that is the absolute ultimate Western. The Western myth and everything about the Old West, it's done so well. Another film of his that you talked about, Pale Rider, which is great. The Outlaw Josie Wales, John Ford's classic Western with John Wayne, almost as a heel, The Searchers, which I think is that's in my personal 25. But my favorite John Wayne movie of all time. Now I'm going to go a little lighter. James Garner, this was on the other night. Support Your Local Sheriff. James Garner was terrific in that. Robert Redford and Paul Newman in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. John Wayne in Rio Bravo. John Wayne in Red River. Now here's one, Barry. I did a Google top 50 Westerns of all time just to jog my memory. So here's one I forgot. Leo DiCaprio in The Revenant. Did you ever see that?
I did. That's a great movie. That's
a
great
holy shit
great movie.
Yeah. So good stuff. Good question, Andy. Okay. This is a real quick one. Rick Nathan wants to know, Barry, who are your favorite Three Stooges?
Oh, I mean, look, if you're answering this,
there's only one answer here, folks.
Exactly. There's only one answer, and it's the originals. It's Larry, Moe, and Curly. Look, I like Shemp, whatever, but it's Larry, Moe, and Curly.
Highlander, there can only be one, Barry. So
there you go. Jamie Ward, the biggest Stooge fan I know, by the way.
Yeah. Okay, so last question submitted by Steve Shoemaker, who purchased a copy of my new book. I almost said Breaking Kayfabe. My new book, They Call Me Booker. Thank you for the purchase, Steve. Steve wants to know, Barry, what were your top five Saturday morning cartoons as a kid?
The Flintstones, the Jetsons. I was 100%. I liked like H.R. Puffin stuff and Sigmund.
Where
and
you
the
go
monsters.
When things get rough?
Yeah, and then those weren't really cartoons. That you know, but I was real. But it, for me, it's Flintstones and Jetsons. I think were always my my two favorite. I liked a lot of the Hanna-Barbera shorts, like Top Cat and those kind of shows. So that's what
okay.
I do.
Okay, so let me throw a few at you real quick. Johnny sure. Quest.
Very good.
Speed yep. Racer.
Race Band.
Yes, exactly.
What was the other one?
Speed Racer.
Speed Racer, sure.
Scooby-Doo. Scooby-Doo. Not with that scrappy dude. I'm talking the original cast there. So yep. the Pink Panther cartoons, remember those?
Yeah, I didn't like those for some reason, but yeah.
Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Yeah.
Okay. Wally Gator.
Loved Wally Gator, absolutely.
And
that's a Hanna-Barbera camp cartoon.
Number one super guy, Hong Kong Phooey.
Also Hanna-Barbera. That's great.
Anyway, so all right, folks, we got to wrap it up for this week. It's been a fun episode. We want to once again give a shout out and a thanks to our boy, Mr. Olympia, for coming on and talking with us here. It was good fun talking with him. We want to thank all you folks for listening. I encourage you to follow me at Bowdren Jeff on Twitter, Breaking Kayfabe, my book, and my second book, They Call Me Booker, both available at crowbarpress.com. Tell Scott Teal I sent you. We want to thank our man, Sweet Lou Pinkman, on the production duties. Thanks so much, Lou, for all you do. And I will leave you with this, folks. After tonight's episode, the one thing you've learned, there's a reason you should not use the blankets on airplanes. We'll see you next week, folks.